Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Russia investigation is creating an ever bigger divide in this country. If you support the president, you probably see a special prosecutor, Congress, the intelligence community, and the mainstream media pushing conspiracy theories to bring down a duly elected commander-in-chief. If you don't support President Trump, you probably see a still untold story of a president compromised, one way or the other, by a foreign power. Somewhere buried in all the mind-numbing details, there is the truth. In progress. This hour On Point, making sense of the Russia investigations. You can join us on air or online. Can you keep up with the Russia investigations? Is your mind made up? How do you see this playing out? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, the life and death of cult leader Charles Manson. But first, we turn to the Russia investigations. And to bring us up to speed, Jeff Begase joins me from Washington, Justice and Homeland Security correspondent for CBS News. Jeff, thanks for taking the time. So great to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So the Senate Judiciary Committee is asking Jared Kushner, son-in-law of the president, for more emails that were apparently sent and received with regard to the Russia investigation. Give us the latest on this aspect of it, Jeff.
Well, we learned on Friday that Kushner's attorney, Abby Lowell, has turned over information to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Just to get you up to date, the Senate Judiciary Committee was looking for several documents and emails, one especially pertaining to what they described as a Russian backdoor overture and dinner invite. And we found out on Friday, and we reported this at CBS News, that there were communications between a man named Alexander Torshin, who is a Kremlin connected banker, someone who is alleged to have had ties to Russian organized crime. He sent a message through an intermediary trying to set up a meeting between Donald Trump and himself at an NRA event in May of 2016 in Kentucky. Now, this email chain went through the top campaign officials, including Paul Manafort and Rick Gates, and eventually ended up in view of Jared Kushner. It was something that he read and responded to. Now, his attorney says that he passed on this meeting.
Declined the meeting, yeah.
He declined the meeting, but this is something that the Senate Judiciary says that it did not receive and it wanted to see. Abby Lowell says that he had been in contact with the staffers of the Senate Judiciary Committee and that they have been trying to comply with all of these requests. But what it revealed was another potential contact between a Russian operative who has ties to the Kremlin and the campaign. And this is before the Trump Tower meeting. Keep in mind, Jane, this is in May of 2016.
Mm-hmm. Here's an interview with CNN yesterday, Jared Kushner's attorney, Abby Lowell, saying that the Senate Judiciary Committee is wrong to accuse Jared Kushner of not disclosing these key documents.
If you look at the contents of these emails, he's the hero. He's the one who's saying there shouldn't be any contacts with foreign officials or foreign entities. That's what the Senate Judiciary Committee should pay attention to and not create some sort of partisan gotcha game.
So partisan gotcha game, Jeff Begase, I mean, how do you see this? Do these additional document requests indicate that Jared Kushner has not been fully forthcoming with Senate investigators, or do they show Kushner is actually declining meetings with the Russians?
Well, listen, Senate investigators and congressional investigators in general don't believe from our reporting that they have been forthcoming entirely. And what we see now developing is this contentious relationship between Kushner and his attorney and this Senate Judiciary Committee that's asking for more information. But we'll have to see where it goes. We know that Abby Lowell said that he's turned over these documents. But the fact that the Senate Judiciary sent this letter, it was a letter that they sent last week, and it raised all of these additional allegations, if you will, against Jared Kushner. So it was a very public way of sending a message to Kushner and his attorney that they wanted more information, that they felt that they were not handing over to congressional investigators.
Tell us about Jared Kushner and WikiLeaks. It now appears that he's the second in the Trump inner circle to be involved with WikiLeaks. Bring us up to date on that.
Well, that's right. Earlier last week, Donald Trump Jr., it was revealed, had been in contact with WikiLeaks between September of 2016 and July of 2017. Now, these were direct messages, some of which appeared in the final stretches of the campaign as WikiLeaks was releasing this stolen information from the DNC. And so that raised a lot of eyebrows. Now, some of that information or some of these contacts with WikiLeaks between Donald Trump Jr. and WikiLeaks were forwarded in email chains to top campaign officials. Jared Kushner received one of those or some of those forwarded emails. Now, his attorney says that these were emails forwarded to him. Kushner was not in direct contact with WikiLeaks. That this was something that Donald Trump Jr. forwarded to top campaign officials, including Jared Kushner.
So the special counsel Robert Mueller is expected to interview White House Communications Director Hope Hicks, among others, in the White House very soon. Is that right? Tell us about the status of Robert Mueller's investigation.
Well, we learned over the weekend that the special counsel, Bob Mueller, has asked the Department of Justice to turn over documents related to the firing of James Comey. And so what that suggests is he is spending a lot of time looking into the White House actions as they relate to James Comey. And so you talk about these interviews. There are several White House officials who are being interviewed by the special counsel's office. We reported last week that Ike Cavalazze, and this is a name that came out over the summer because he was in that Trump Tower meeting in June 9th of 2016. So he has been interviewed by the special counsel's office. And that's important, too, because, again, it points not only to White House involvement, but this meeting at Trump Tower in June of 2016, in which Donald Trump Jr. was promised dirt on Hillary Clinton. And this was an email that he responded to. The meeting took place. Ike Cavalazze was there. So not only is the special counsel's office paying close attention to what happened in the White House leading up to the firing of James Comey, but also he's paying attention to this meeting in June of 2016 at Trump Tower.
So what should we look for next, Jeff Begase, in this investigation?
Well, more revelations about what the special counsel is up to these days. You know, we expected that this would be a pretty tightly sealed investigation with Robert Mueller at the helm, and it has been. However, there have still been some leaks coming out in terms of what the special counsel's office is up to. However, you know, even though we are getting some information, you can bet that the special counsel's office is light years away in terms of what's coming out now and what the public is hearing about. So that is something to watch, the next step for the special counsel's office, but also what's happening on Capitol Hill. I reported last week that congressional investigators are interested in subpoenaing Twitter because they're trying to get more information on these communications between Donald Trump Jr. and WikiLeaks.
Mm. All right. We will watch it, and we'll have you back. Jeff Begase, Justice and Homeland Security Correspondent for CBS News. He joins me from Washington. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jane.
Joining me now from Washington, Jonathan Lande, investigative reporter for Reuters. Jonathan, thank you for taking the time.
Good. Hi, how are you?
Hello,
Jane.
Nice to have you. And from Los Angeles, Max Boot, Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Max, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jonathan, I'll start with you. From your perspective as an investigative reporter, you've been all over this story. What do we need to know to understand about this Russia investigation right now?
I think you have to go back to statements made both by President Trump and his now Attorney General, Jeff Sessions and other people who worked in the Trump campaign who insisted time and again that there were no connections between the campaign or anyone at the campaign and Russia or Russians. And the fact is they set by continually insisting on that, they essentially set themselves up for all of the questions that are being asked now because of the revelations that indeed there were numerous connections between people in the campaign at fairly senior levels, including Don Jr., and Russians. And by doing that, you just simply keep piquing people's interest and curiosity and fueling questions about why were they so adamant about no connections when indeed there were multiple connections.
Max Boot, you are a conservative, but you've never been a fan of Donald Trump. I mean, what about Jonathan's point? By insisting time and time and again that there have been no connections to Russia, has Trump inner circle set themselves up here?
Well, of course. And I think it's important to point out that if we knew before the election what we have since learned, it would have been huge news. I mean, this would have been a massive, massive scandal, far greater than was actually the case. I mean, think about this. The Washington Post just noted a few days ago the Trump campaign interacted with Russians at least 31 times throughout the campaign, and there were at least 19 known meetings. So 31 interactions, 19 known meetings, and that's probably lowballing it because those are just the ones that we know about. And the whole time, as Jonathan was just saying, they were consistently lying and saying that there were no interactions at all. I mean, just last week we learned that Donald Trump Jr. was in contact with WikiLeaks and that Jared Kushner and the rest of the campaign high command knew about this, and yet they consistently said we had no connection to WikiLeaks. I mean, this would have blown their cover story out of the water, but basically they managed to lie and bluff their way through the election, and now the truth is starting to come out, and now the indictments are starting to come in.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the latest developments in the Russia investigation this hour and what the president, the people around him did or didn't know. You can join the conversation. What's your prediction? Will the investigations fizzle? Will they explode? Jonathan Lande is an investigative reporter for Reuters. You can find a link to his excellent reporting on this at our website, onpointradio.org. And Max Boot, senior fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a conservative but critical and no fan of this president. Here's some sound during his testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee last week. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was grilled about inconsistencies in his past statements about contacts with Russians during the presidential campaign. Here he is speaking to the committee.
In all of my testimony, I can only do my best to answer your questions as I understand them and to the best of my memory. But I will not accept and reject accusations that I have ever lied. That is a lie.
And days after he was grilled in Congress, Jeff Sessions opened a speech at the Federalist Society on Friday, making light of this entire controversy.
Is Ambassador Kislyak in the room? Before I get started here, any Russians?
And on November 11th, at a press briefing in Hanoi on his recent trip to Asia, President Trump reaffirmed his belief that Russia did not influence the outcome of the U.S. presidential election.
I believe that President Putin really feels, and he feels strongly, that he did not meddle in our election.
So, Jonathan Landay, there we hear President Trump talking about Vladimir Putin. We heard Sessions before that, the Attorney General. What should we know, based on your reporting, about what the Attorney General did know about all this and how his story may or may have not changed in the course of this?
So it comes down to the fact that then-Senator Sessions, when he was an advisor to the campaign, actually did have two meetings with the then-Russian ambassador, Kislyak here, one, I believe, at the GOP convention and one here in Washington. Also, he was present at a speech then-candidate Trump gave, foreign policy speech that was attended by Mr. Kislyak. But then we should go to a photograph that President Trump put on his Instagram account back during the campaign, a March 2016 meeting of Mr. Trump and his foreign policy advisors. And there in the photograph is a man by the name of George Papadopoulos. He pleaded guilty to a count of lying to the FBI about contacts he had had with Russians or through intermediaries to Russians about arranging a meeting between then-candidate Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Mr. Papadopoulos told the FBI, according to the statement that was released by Mr. Mueller's office, that he brought up that proposal at that very particular meeting at which Mr. Trump was in the chair, as well as then-Senator Sessions. We also know that another campaign advisor, Carter Page, mentioned to then-Senator Sessions that he was going on a trip to Russia. That would have been in June. His trip, I believe, was in June of 2016. He claimed an unrelated trip, a trip unrelated to the campaign, that he mentioned this to then-Senator Sessions at a dinner here in Washington, D.C. Now, we've had the Attorney General under oath at his confirmation hearing, and then again, I believe, in October at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, at which he denied knowing about any connections between or any contacts between people with the campaign and Russians. And then last week before the House Judiciary Committee, he said he changed his both of those statements to say that he had been reminded by news reports that, in fact, he had chaired this meeting. But he said he has had a hazy recollection of that meeting. And yet he then clearly told the campaign that he had shut down this proposal by Mr. Papadopoulos. So there is a bit of a contradiction there.
Max Boot, jump in here. I'm reading the Washington Post. One Republican operative in frequent contact with the White House described Robert Mueller, the special counsel's team, as working through the White House staff like Pac-Man. How do you see this? And we had the indictment, of course, of Paul Manafort. Who do you see next, if anyone?
Well, the widespread speculation is that Mike Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, is going to be the next to either be indicted or cop a plea deal, and his son is also very vulnerable. I mean, clearly what Robert Mueller has done here is he has assembled an outstanding team of investigators, the best of the best, and they are putting together a textbook investigation as they would of an organized crime family or a complex financial conspiracy. They're working their way from the outside in, from the bottom up. They are going after the most vulnerable people that they can find, including Paul Manafort, the former campaign manager, including George Papadopoulos, the former foreign policy aide. And they are targeting them, hoping to use those cases to go after others and build their case. And I would say that that many people around Trump, including son-in-law Jared Kushner, including son Donald Trump Jr., are very vulnerable. Because the bottom line is, and just to pull back from, you know, all the details, which we need, you know, it's proper to focus on the details, but we also need to pull back and understand that at this point, there is no doubt in my mind that there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. The only question now is, what did the president know, and when did he know it? And to what extent is Donald Trump himself personally implicated in this collusion? I think you will see evidence that he probably was quite aware of what was going on. But that's the case that Robert Mueller is currently in the process of trying to assemble.
Let's get Mark in here from North Tonawanda, New York. Hi, Mike. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My opinion on this as an independent, I think the Russian investigation going on for 10 months now, there's really nothing to it. To me, it seems like the Democrats are just cannot handle the loss and are doing anything to go after Trump. But, I mean, there are things that are out there, the meetings and everything. But on the other hand, what presidential candidate never had meetings with all the other countries? I'm sure Trump had meetings with not only Russia, but China, Japan, every country. So I don't think that's a big deal. And I think the ties between Uranium One and the Clinton Foundation is a much bigger tie of collusion. You got 20% of the uranium going to Russia, and the foundation got $145 million. It just seems like a lot of money pay for play. So that's my opinion.
Mark, thank you. Mark brings up an important point about the Uranium One deal. Here is former Deputy Assistant to the President Sebastian Gorka talking with Fox News host Sean Hannity last week. In his view, the real scandal and the one that we'll soon see justice on is the Uranium One deal.
The heat is on, and finally we have a chance. I know Fox viewers have been very, very cynical that these people are Teflon-coated and they never pay the price for their crimes, but it seems as if finally, under a Trump administration, this rampant criminal cartel, which goes by the name of Clinton, will finally see some form of justice in the near future.
So, Jonathan Landay, what about the counter-investigations here? Mark brings up Uranium One. Republicans want the Attorney General to set up a separate investigation to look at that Clinton uranium deal. What about that? Where does it stand?
So this is something that has been pushed by both the president and his partisans. It's an allegation that somehow the former Secretary of State persuaded nine members of a U.S. committee called the U.S. Foreign Investment Committee on Foreign Investments to all vote in favor of allowing or approving the sale of a Canadian company that had an interest in about 20% of the U.S. uranium stocks to be purchased by Russia's state-run nuclear agency called Rosatom. So the fact is that there have been members of that committee who have said that Secretary Clinton had absolutely nothing to do with that vote. The committee itself is chaired by the Treasury Department. That deal also had to be approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as well as then President Obama. And there have been five investigations by congressional committees into this so-called allegation that somehow this donation to the Clinton campaign years before the sale was the key to a conspiracy in which then Secretary of State Clinton persuaded all of these entities to vote in favor of the deal. Now, the fact is, it's my understanding, I believe that it's been on the record, that no uranium controlled by Uranium One, and that was then purchased by Rosatom, ever left the United States.
Well, in fact, Max Boot, the Washington Post I'm seeing here has rated claims that 20% of the U.S. uranium went to Russia. They rated that claim with four Pinocchios. How do you see this part of the investigation?
This is just errant BS. There is no Uranium One scandal. Let me repeat this again. There is no Uranium One scandal. This is a bogus allegation cooked up by Trump and his followers to distract attention from the actual scandal, which is the connections between the Trump campaign and Russia. Trump has been doing this over and over again during the past year. For example, he made up a bogus allegation that President Trump had wiretapped him. That is completely false and has been exposed. But they just move on. Now they're making these claims about Uranium One. They're making claims that something called the Steele dossier is the real scandal because the Clinton campaign tried to fund an effort by a former British intelligence operative to uncover the Trump-Russia links, and therefore, according to Trump, that's the scandal. It's not the underlying links, but the attempts by the Democrats to uncover those links. This is just nonsense, okay? Do not be distracted by this. Keep your eye on the ball, and the ball here is the Mueller investigation. The ball here is the links between Trump and Russia, which are outrageous that you have this amount of links, this what appears to be collusion between an American presidential campaign and a hostile foreign power. And let me rebut one other point that this caller made, falsely claiming to be an independent when he's obviously a rabid Trump fan. One of the points that he made is, he's sure that the Trump campaign had a comparable number of other communications with other foreign countries, and this is completely normal. Well, A, there is no sign whatsoever that the Trump campaign met with any other country to the extent that they met with the Russians. And B, I was a Republican foreign policy advisor on the campaigns of John McCain, Mitt Romney, and Marco Rubio. And I can assure you, we never had this level of interaction with any foreign power, much less a hostile foreign power. And I can tell you something else, that if Senator McCain or Governor Romney or somebody else had learned that a hostile foreign power like Russia was offering to provide dirt on his campaign opponent, his reaction would have been to call the FBI, not to say, I love it, which is what Donald Trump Jr. said when the Russians reached out promising dirt on the Russians. So that's the real scandal. It's not this bogus Uranium One nonsense that the White House is peddling.
Let me get Wes in here from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Wes. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Does Mueller's team have access to Trump's financial documents and tax returns yet? In my mind, Trump's behavior around his tax returns is a huge piece of this puzzle and forms the motivation behind a lot of this.
Jonathan Landry, Russ, thanks for the call. Do you know? Do we know?
No, we don't. As one of as your previous guest pointed out, this is a really airtight investigation that's going on. There have been very few, if any, leaks coming out of Mr. Mueller's office. Now, there's no doubt that as a special counsel, he has the power to subpoena the president's finances and the finances of anyone he deems that he needs to look into. But whether or not he has actually done that, we don't know.
Russia's ambassador to Washington, Sergei Kislyak, has always insisted that his numerous meetings with Trump campaign officials were all part of an ambassador's normal job. He was on Russian TV last week on a TV talk show, and one of the hosts asked him, could you list who you met with, spoke with by phone, so we could know for the future who they, meaning the Americans, will be asking to interrogate? Flynn, Sessions, who else? His answer did not exactly help the Trump administration's cause. Here it is. Kislyak says, first, I'm never going to do that. And second, the list is so long that I'm not going to be able to go through it in 20 minutes. You know, we just have a couple of minutes left here. I guess, Max Boot, Jonathan Landay, what's clear is that if you are a Trump supporter, you see all of this as an awful tearing down of this president. If you don't like Donald Trump, you see this as a conspiracy by Democrats trying to make something out of very little. What's your perspective? Max Boot, is this a Democratic effort to undermine a Republican administration? Is there more here? How do you see it?
It's ridiculous to suggest this is a Democratic effort. Robert Mueller is not a Democrat, okay? He was appointed director of the FBI by George W. Bush, okay? He has a history of having been appointed by the Republican Party. Nobody in Washington commands more bipartisan support than Bob Mueller. This has nothing to do with a partisan conspiracy of any kind. Mueller is after the truth, and I am fairly confident that he will get it. Again, the attempt to suggest that this is somehow a Democratic plot because they can't get over losing the election and so forth, that's the nonsensical White House talking point. Your listeners should not fall for that. This is a massive scandal, potentially far worse than Watergate. This is because if the allegations are true and the Trump campaign colluded with a hostile foreign power to affect the outcome of the American election, That's a monstrous crime which strikes at the very heart of our democracy. And we need to get to the truth about that, and we should not be distracted by all the attempts from the White House to deflect attention to nonsensical Clinton scandals or to claim this is a Democratic conspiracy. It's not. This is a massive scandal that needs to be thoroughly investigated.
Jonathan Landay, you get the last word here. Trump supporters, you know, still many of them don't buy it. What do you say? Far worse than Watergate, this Russia investigation?
That's yet to be seen. But the one thing that we haven't really focused on very much is the fact that U.S. intelligence agencies, three of them, found that Russia conducted a massive influence campaign in the U.S. Elections in 2016 that were aimed at swinging the vote to Donald Trump and away from Hillary Clinton. You would have to ask Trump supporters whether or not they have confidence any longer in their own U.S. intelligence community, something that the president seems not to have.
Jonathan Landay, investigative reporter for Reuters. Great information, great reporting. Jonathan, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure.
Max Boot, Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His upcoming book is called The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam. Max, great to have you with us. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we look at the life and death of cult leader Charles Manson. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Charles Manson, one of the most notorious murderers of the 20th century, died yesterday at the age of 83 in a hospital in Kern County, California, after spending most of his life behind bars. He has remained perhaps the most iconic, most enigmatic cult leaders in the modern American imagination. You can join us. Are you old enough to remember when Charles Manson and his gang burst into the headlines? If you're too young to remember those dark days, what does Charles Manson mean to you now? Joining me from Fort Worth, Texas is Jeff Gwynn, author of Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff, welcome to On Point.
Hi, nice to be your guest.
Well, thank you for being here. Remind us of Charles Manson and the grisly killing spree in Los Angeles in August 1969.
Manson has remained famous, or maybe notorious is the better word, ever since the Tate-LaBianca murders in August 1969. There was another murder that preceded them, another one afterward, making 9 victims total. Because Manson is such a master of manipulating the media and the public, he's managed to stay, unfortunately, relevant all these years, to the point where now, for many younger people, he's sort of an iconic figure, a cool rebel, when in fact he was a blue-collar, murderous, sociopathic thug. But Manson always bragged he was the man of 1,000 hats. He could appear to be all kinds of different things without any real effort at all. And sadly, when you look at the attention even his death is bringing, he succeeded in what he wanted most, which was getting attention.
So Charles Manson was a semi-literate, habitual criminal, the wide-eyed leader of the Manson family. Tell us about this murderous band of young drifters that carried out these murders.
They sound much worse than they should have been. Manson, at his height of powers, could never attract and keep more than a couple dozen drug-addled young followers, almost all of them with issues with their families and part of that late 60s brigade of kids who were wandering America trying to find some guru who would tell them what to do and how to do it. Manson gradually, because he was a gifted demagogue, separated them from their family, any friends they had, preached his own twisted gospel, which included a coming race war where the blacks would eliminate the whites, but Manson and his followers would ultimately emerge to rule the world. And if that sounds kind of far out, remember how many drugs they were taking at the time. That was also part of Manson's.
Let me play this clip from a 1973 documentary. This is Charles Manson describing the family, quote-unquote, that he had as outcasts who made their own reality.
The people you call my family were people that you didn't want, children that were alongside the road that their parents had kicked out. So I took them to my garbage dump and fed them and taught them that in love there's no wrong. Everything they've done for love of brother.
He literally rode around in a ramshackle bus, Jeff Gwynn, sought out converts, explained the hold he had on his followers.
What Manson was skillful at doing was finding young people in particular with very little self-respect who were alienated from the world, who'd pretty much been the kids who were always ignored, and explained to them that they were special, that he was the one who loved them, and they should leave their blood relations and join a real family. The famous school bus, when they drove all around parts of the country supposedly exploring, was really Manson's way of getting them away from any outside influences. Again, we shouldn't ascribe to Charles Manson something any more than he was. Before he got into the murder business, he was a fairly unsuccessful pimp, but he used the same techniques that pimps use to get a string of young women. Find the ones with no self-esteem and make them feel somehow beholden to you. It worked then for him in some ways, and again, it worked to murderous effect later on with young kids.
Let me get Wade in here from Burnsville, North Carolina. Hi, Wade. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
I don't think we should have kept him up all these years or anybody similar to him that's committed murders and lived a life of crime. And they shouldn't make an excuse of drugs was his influence. It made him the way he was.
So Wade makes a good point, Jeff Gwynn. Initially, Charles Manson was sentenced to death, right? What happened?
The California Supreme Court ruled that death was a cruel and unusual punishment, and Manson and the followers who'd been sentenced to death instead received life sentences. What I've always believed was that the death sentence was wrong. Anybody could always be rehabilitated, that no one was beyond being reached somehow. But after spending years studying Charles Manson's life, I've reluctantly concluded, yes, there are people. Very few instances, but there are people where the death penalty would have been appropriate. Instead, Charlie had all these years since 1969 to occasionally pull some of his stunts to stay in front of the public eye and to continue to get the attention that he always craved.
The most famous of Charles Manson's victims was Sharon Tate, an actress who was married to the film director Roman Polanski. She was 8.5 months pregnant at the time. He had other high-profile victims. Remind us of the gruesome nature of his crimes.
Manson, though he didn't participate in the Tate-LaBianca murders himself, orchestrated them, though he made his followers believe that, in a sense, they were doing what they wanted to do as well as what Charlie wanted. He wanted the murders to be really horrific. He wanted the murder scenes to be disgusting in their explicitness because he wanted reporters, he wanted the media to believe that these acts were committed by black militants. It was a way, again, of, in his words, precipitating helter-skelter, the race war. That didn't work. But still, Manson thought that he would at least demonstrate to his followers that he could cause things to happen, that he was important. Look at us, the media, the newspapers, TV, they're talking about us. So everything he did, he was using other people for his own ends, and that's the classic definition of a sociopath.
And so help us understand Charles Manson in the context of the time that he lived in, the time that these murders happened, the turbulent late 60s, an era of race riots, of street protests. How did he refine his sick message, if you will, to fit those times?
There was nothing unique about Charles Manson's philosophy. He stole ideas from the Bible, from the lyrics of the Beatles, and most of all from Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. There was absolutely nothing original about him. But what he did do, as any demagogue does, is to come into a moment of cultural upheaval and exaggerate even further some of the dangers, the race riots going on in major cities. He translates this, rising up, we're going to have a race war. So, again, he was a classic demagogue. He wasn't particularly talented in that. He couldn't retain most of his followers that long. But what Charles Manson was an amazingly talented public relations expert who knew how to manipulate the media, the courts, and everything else. That's why we're still talking about him all these years later.
Let's go to Joel in Wausau, Wisconsin. Hi, Joel. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call and to your guest. So I actually was one of the people, I was really interested in Helter Skelter when I was in high school, and I was interested because I thought, what is it that takes a man and makes him do this? And I'm convinced, you know, you keep talking about how you wanted attention, and I think that's, as I understand it, is another one.
Oh, dear. Joel, we're losing your line. Call back if you can. From my notes here, I see that that you believe from your study of Charles Manson that he really had no childhood. His mother was a teenage prostitute, and he was in the system, really, Jeff Gwynn, at a very early age. Tell us about this early life of Charles Manson, who was very troubled.
A lot of it was completely made up by Manson himself. His mother was not a teenage prostitute, though she did go to prison for theft at one point when Charlie was five. But he was part of a loving family that took him in. He was never on his own. He made everything sound much worse than it was, trying to present himself as a victim. In fact, there's times as a child he would attack other people. He was fascinated with knives. In school, he would organize kids to beat up other kids he didn't like, and then when he got in trouble, would tell the principal, it wasn't me, they were doing what they wanted to do. And all those years later, that was his defense in Tate LaBianca. There is no reason to feel sorry for him because he had a terrible childhood. He was responsible for everything he did.
He was charming, and he was terrifying. There were two sides to him, were there not?
There were many sides to Manson. He could charm anyone he wanted to, but the real depth of his character was frightening, not in that he was insane. He was never crazy. The scariest thing about Charles Manson was that he was coldly calculating. As Leslie Van Houten, one of the convicted killers who talked to me for the book, said, nothing Charlie did was ever spontaneous. It was always part of a plot. There's no reason to feel sorry for Manson, and I think the worst thing about him was that he knew what he was doing the whole time.
5 years ago, Charles Manson was denied parole. At his hearing, California Parole Board member John Peck quoted a statement that Charles Manson made to a prison psychologist. Here's that.
I am special. I am not like the average inmate. I have put five people in the grave. I've been in prison most of my life. I am a very dangerous man. And this panel agrees with that statement.
Jeff Gwynn, in fact, several of Manson's followers went before the parole board asking to be released. Have any of them been released?
The problem for them is that no California governor wants to be the one who is nailed by the media for pardoning a Manson family killer. The parole boards have occasionally recommended that Manson followers be released. The governors have yet to approve that. I don't think they ever will.
Here's Donna in Grosse Pointe Farms, Michigan. Hi, Donna. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Yes, the Manson murders happened just as I was celebrating my 21st birthday. I was absolutely horrified. And ever since then, whenever I hear the song Helter Skelter, I just go crazy because I was a huge Beatles fan being that age. And I feel that in some way his legend has been romanticized. I'm not a person that believes in the death penalty in most cases, but because they let him live and speak from time to time, I feel that they perpetuated this so-called legend, and I'm glad that he's passed on.
Donna, thank you. Jeff Gwynn, it's a great point. Has his legend been romanticized by his frequent appearances on television and at these parole board hearings?
Definitely. In some sense, we can sort of consider him a criminal Kardashian. He knew how to play the public, and he's done it extremely well. I never believed in the death penalty until I started researching Charles Manson, and the more I learned about him, the more I found myself changing my opinion. That was a hard thing for me to do, but this is a man who never once in his life did anything of benefit to anyone else other than himself.
The Manson family has occupied a dark, persistent place, as we've heard, as Donna mentioned, in American culture and American commerce, Jeff Gwynn. I mean, talk about things that he's inspired, pop songs and opera, films, a host of internet fan sites, T-shirts, many nonfiction books, most famously Helter Skelter.
And even a phone ringtone of some of his really terrible music, if you'd like that. Again, Manson understood how to manipulate not just individuals but the public at large. He was a small-time demagogue who got all kinds of publicity that kind of pushed him forward. If he'd been paroled at any point, he just would have gone on to do something even worse because he would have wanted more and more attention. The money part, pardon the expression, pissed him off because he wasn't making any of it. Up till the day he died, he was trying to sell his art to fans who wrote into him, and his art would consist of pictures of spiders, swastikas, and the words helter skelter, usually misspelled.
Has there been an answer to the question of his mental health issues? Was he a sociopath, a paranoid schizophrenic? Any answers?
I believe after I talked to all kinds of professionals who study this kind of thing and then took their conclusions to the people who've known Manson. I believe, yes, he was a sociopath. But when we hear that term, we shouldn't interpret it as someone who's insane and doesn't know what he's doing. Manson always knew what he was doing. That's the frightening thing about him.
Charlie Rose interviewed Charles Manson and asked him if he felt remorse. Remind us of his answer and how he felt about those murders, about his legacy all these years later.
Well, Manson would always say that he didn't need to feel remorseful because he didn't do it. The other people were doing what they wanted to do. Again, sociopaths don't feel remorse. Manson, throughout his life, thought he deserved to have anything he wanted and couldn't be blamed for anything he did. If you look for remorse in those people, you're wasting your time. Ultimately, Manson was, in a very horrible way, a success. He did what he wanted to do. He became known and became influential. In that sense, he was powerful. The world's a better place without him.
Charles Manson, one of the most notorious murderers of the 20th century, dead at the age of 83. Jeff Gwynn is author of Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. He joins me from Fort Worth, Texas. Jeff, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, 20 years after Bill Clinton's sex scandal, is it time to rethink how that all played out and its lessons for right now? I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.